Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I just don't think it looks like a Lamborghini. I can't believe Marcello Gandini had anything to do with it.
I've never owned one. I've never wanted one. And I feel sad about that because really we should.
What if I stayed in that lane for the duration of my journey?
I'd have shot you.
Hello and welcome to the Collecting Addicts podcast, episode number 47. We've made it through pretty much the calendar year. It's 2024. None of us thought we'd be here, but we still are. To kick off this year's podding, how about this for a topic? Because it's so open to interpretation, I don't know where to begin, but I will begin with Neil Clifford, who posted, best car games. What do you mean by it? What are your favourites?
Well, I have a secret game that I haven't actually shared with anyone, including my wife. And it sounds a little macabre, really, but it's not. If I've got a piece of dirt or, even more annoying, a stone chip on my windscreen, I pretend it's a gun.
Gun sight.
But not in a sort of modern-day drive-by shooting, let's just kill people for the sake of it type of shooting. I pretend I'm a Spitfire pilot.
Of course.
So you know when you're driving along, well, obviously, if you're in a Spitfire, I've never done this, you obviously have to shoot ahead or you have to judge where the plane is going. So I do that for cars or, in fact, people when I'm driving along. So I actually, getting a stone chip on my windscreen is often quite joyful because it means I now have a gun in my 991 Turbo S, which I can then pretend to shoot people.
Do you have windscreen insurance?
I've never used that.
So do you keep stone chips on the windscreen longer than you need to? So you've got a gun sight.
Yes, I do.
So is it actually a real wrench for you to get a screen replaced?
The only windscreen I've replaced is a G-Wagon, which I think we had about three of the bloody things because it's so vertical. Right. That it's very easy to break. So I did use the windscreen insurance on the G-Wagon. Apart from that...
Oh,
he's gone. Get a photo of it. That's a good one. Get a photo of it.
And I'm
on my A10.
He's back. Damn. Okay.
So do you find yourself, Neil, when you're doing that, do you find yourself... Because I totally get that. And that, the idea of thinking about how much lead to give the car or the pedestrian. Do you find yourself, because I know I would, sort of steering the car like you would your Spitfire, sort of banking it a bit and so forth, just so you got the right amount of lead.
Just to confirm for audiences that have bad audio connection, Chris Cooper said banking. Okay, good.
I don't find it that enjoyable shooting the actual pedestrians. It's more about people that are driving along in the middle lane.
Yeah.
It's those types of people, or the worst ones, the undertakers, You know, you're going along at maybe a slightly notch over the speed limit, and along comes a 4D number plate Mercedes black E-Class and just zooms up the inside lane and sort of swerves in between lots of cars. It's those people I like to shoot.
Do you make a dagger noise when you're doing it?
No, silent.
Yeah, be slightly careful, because that might be Chris Harris or I nipping up the inside of you, especially if you're passing around in the wrong lane.
So you're saying that people that drive Mercedes-Benz's E-classes are look like they're Turkish or Iranian?
No, only if they're undertaking.
Okay.
The undertaking element.
How long? Here's a question for you. How long, if you move from the outside lane, or if you move to an inner lane, how long do you need to go for in that lane before it stops being undertaking? So if you were in the outside lane and I pulled into the inside lane, went past you, but I stayed in that lane for 3 miles, is that still undertaking?
No, that's still undertaking.
Is it?
Yes.
Yeah.
What if I stayed in that lane for the duration of my journey?
I'd have shot you.
I do what you do, monkey. Yeah.
Yeah. No. So here's a question for you, Chris Cooper. Sorry, Neil Clifford. How much would you pay to have a real gun fitted to a car?
Oh. The problem
just
is...
Just 5 blanks.
Okay. All right. Blanks. $5,000.
Oh, I like it. I can remember when we filmed on Top Gear, we filmed a thing with that crazy Aston continuation DB5 they did with all the bombs.
Yes.
A couple of million quid. And Paddy was the one that did the review on it. And it was done beautifully by Aston Martin's special works project place. It was such a clever thing. Obviously, you couldn't road register it, which meant it was virtually pointless. But it had the rotating number plates. It was an absolute copy of the car from the film. But there was a sequence we did at the end where I think Fred, bless him, was dressed as Jaws. I was dressed as Knick Knack. And we were being chased by Paddy in this Aston. When we saw the onboards, and I think this is universal. Paddy had a fake gun situation coming out of the front of the overriders of the Aston Martin, and he's convinced they're real guns. When you watch the onboard, he can hear him going. It's like they're real guns. Like, even if you're 50 years old. And they're fake, you convince yourself they're real.
Yes, 100%. Yeah. I would definitely.
Absolutely convinced they were real, he was. Okay, so you've answered that question in a way I totally didn't expect you to. So what I've written here, Mario Kart, I need to go back to the drawing board and work out what you actually meant by best car game. Yeah. Manish, what's your favourite car game?
When I was a kid, my father used to hate us doing anything like It or singing in the back of a car. So he used to bribe us, my sister and me, by giving us, I think it was a pound, which in 1974 was like giving a six-year-old 10 quid. So basically, it was lots and lots of sweets. But I did have a very good friend, and we used to play Neil Clifford's favorite game in the back of a car, which is Top Trumps. There is no better way of getting two young boys to shut the fuck up in the back of a car than 5 pence. Of various sort, Top Trump supercars is absolutely. It was the way to play it. Was
that a Mercedes SSK on there?
Yeah, and an SLC. Yeah,
best set is the one from the late 70s. It's got the BB and the Ferrari Pinin in the pack.
Just brilliant. I think that was supercars.
It's the one that's the brick. It's got the Sparrow in it.
Yeah.
Well, honestly, it's the
Bricklin.
Never invented.
That's what it was. The Bricklin. Yeah.
Yeah.
Whoever invented Top Trumps, you know.
Okay, I've got Top Trumps down, so that's one of mine gone. Chris Cooper.
So I didn't think it was games. I did think it was games. I think it was things you do with your car, which is a bit of a game. So I think it's a really cool game, particularly in like stop and start traffic on the motorway, to play that game where you never stop.
Oh, that's good.
You never stop. And you sort of like, you look, it's quite good. You look ahead and you think, where's the traffic, that ebb and flow? It's a sort of, I could do a little side essay here on the sort of the dynamics of queuing theory as to why traffic actually stops when the volume and sort of, there's a graph in here, one of our graphs, and probably some differential calculus. We'll leave that to another occasion because it looks like Monkey's Wi-Fi is frozen, but it hasn't. He's just cross.
I thought you couldn't do maths, Chris.
No, I can't do maths. That's much. So
what does differential calculus mean?
Judging that, okay, it looked, there's some red lights, they've all stopped.
Yes.
People in the next lane are going up and going, and everyone's
you don't need differential calculus. I mean, that's,
yeah. So you think, I'm just going to ease off the gas. I'm going to roll up. It looks like I might hit them, but I can see and I know that the traffic in front of the car stopped in front of me is moving. And then for the person behind me, I've given them a joyous, uninterrupted little waft through the traffic. So not stopping the motorway is quite a good game.
That's a good game.
You're not that wanker that nips between lanes of almost stationary traffic, are you?
No, that's cheating.
Good.
That's good. Cheating.
Because that's the kind of thing Ebba would do.
Yeah, I would never do that. In fact, I would never, ever, ever do that. No, I wouldn't ever.
Do people get annoyed behind you when you do that, though, Chris? Because they think.
No, I think quite the opposite. I think the opposite, because they suddenly realise, do you know what? This lane seems to be quite smooth running. I've no idea how and why. So the other game I like playing.
I've got to stop you. I've got one key question to ask you. So at that point, you are effectively managing the time of the people behind you. You're saying to them, I'm going to give you a smooth ride. You don't need to accelerate or brake as frequently. But you're doing that based on the fact you can control the distance you have to the car in front. So what happens when, to use a name, Chris Harris pops out in front of you and reduces that distance by half, and suddenly you can't provide your followers with such a smooth run?
So the good news in that case is that you can usually spot the body language. Another thing we talk about at some point other time is, what do we learn from the body language of other road users? And having been in the passenger seat of Harris C and various borrowed motor cars from kind and generous press departments of premium, high-end and sports car manufacturers, I know a lot about body language. So you can tell the bloke, you can see him in the near side mirror, you think, here comes a, let's just call them a Harris. Here comes a Harris. And
that's,
you can
unfair.
See they're sniffing. They're sniffing that little gap in front.
Although I do remember once you turning around to me and saying, why don't you drive our race car like that?
Which I thought was unfair.
Move on.
So the other quite good game. I've got a couple. I'll limited one because I've got a lot to get through. That game you play where you can increase and watch the increases in average speed and average MPG.
Yeah, I could.
I love that game.
I thought you didn't like numbers. I'm just confused.
It's just, I won't say what the numbers are, but a while ago I sent to the group a photograph that my wife took, because she was in the passenger seat, of the little trip computer thing saying average speed and average MPG. And there were two quite nice round numbers. A bit of symmetry in there, which we know is important. And that's such a satisfying game to sort of drive in that way where you see the average speed creeping up. And in Land Rover products, it gives you a little on the dash, and a Jaguar as well, it gives you a little green-coloured throttle pedal to say, you're driving well. So that green-coloured throttle pedal and watching the average MPG and the average speed going, oh, that's a satisfying game. I love those games.
Let's move to Edward.
That's a scary game to play, Chris, in a G-Wagon, to see how low you can get the consumption number when you floor the throttle.
That is the inverse.
What's the one car maker that doesn't provide an MPG readout?
Ooh. Tell us, Christopher.
Ferrari.
Ah.
There is no MPG at all on any of their cars. They couldn't give a...
Surely there must be in the digital. No, not at all?
Nope, there is no MPG. No one wants to know they're doing 4 MPG in their 812.
Yeah, that's true.
No difference. Right, go on then. Edward?
Well, I didn't leave London over Christmas. I didn't leave the M25. And obviously, having 3 children around Christmas, it's quite an intense time. So the game I decided to teach them was catch the cigarette lighter.
You mean the hot cigarette lighter?
Yeah. No, I'm joking. That's only carrying on from the silly things I've done in cars. The game I used to love playing, and I think I've said this one before, in France, driving through France as a young boy, and I still do it now, is there are 95 different department numbers on the number plates in France.
Yes.
And seeing if I can get from Calais to Megève, and how many of those numbers you can see on the motorway. It's actually a lot harder than it used to be, because a lot of the French choose not to use the toll roads and they use the A road. Is it the A roads, the National Highway?
Route Nationale.
The Route Nationale. Yeah. So it's a far harder game to play nowadays.
Are you writing these down? Because if there are 95 departments.
No, as kids, we used to leave either London or Megève and we used to write 1 to 95 on a piece of paper.
Literally writing them down.
No. We'd put 1 to 95 and then we'd put circles around them as we go through them. Yeah.
Was that when you had a really big rear headrest in the car and you could just hold a piece of paper against the rear headrest and just sort of draw circles around it?
That sort of thing, yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine.
In the summer in the Maybach Launderlay, we used to take the roof down.
Very good, very good.
He's not kidding, is he?
No, he really isn't. So I thought this is open interpretation. I sort of a bit like a scrum under the post 10 yards out. I split my backs. So I've got top trumps. I've got Gran Turismo, first edition, Mario Kart. To answer the technical question, best car games, as in games and cars.
Yeah, yeah.
But in the car, I think if you listen to Cabin Pressure again, Yellow Car is a brilliant game. Arthur's explanation of Yellow Car when someone says, when do it end? And there's this lovely pause and he goes, it never ends. I love that, Yellow Car.
Yeah. What is it? You've got to see the Yellow Car first.
You see a Yellow Car. You just have to say Yellow Car. That's it.
It's like Panda in Sicily.
Yeah, exactly that. So I think, but actually, as I sort of ruminated on this when I was writing them down earlier, I thought to myself, the car games is almost a place at which you can define whether you're an addict or not. Because an addict doesn't need games. Because an addict is so fascinated by the car environment around them that you're always looking. You know, I almost don't have time to have car games. Because I'm looking at the thing behind me thinking, if I smash the throttle now, is he going to be quicker than me? Has he got better? Does my internal data computer tell me he's got a really good 50 to 70 time inside there? What's that up the inside? Why has that got that exhaust on it? That's the wrong badge for that trim. You know, you're actually always
busy.
You're always playing games in your head, aren't you? And so I think that's what I'm always doing. But the one I do that is perpetual for me is I'm either matching range against distance, both in my head and on the computer.
Yeah.
I play a game. I use Apple Maps the whole time because I have done for years. But I'm always trying to work out whether my calculated time of arrival is more accurate than the computer.
Yes. And I
know when I'm guilty. Sometimes if I get it wrong, I'll adjust my speed at the end of the journey to get it closer to my ETA.
Yeah, I've never done that.
Racing the nav is
racing the nav.
So those are mine. But I think the real addict is always so busy in the car, and actually that's why sometimes, even though we love having passengers, the biggest drawback is having people in the car that fecking talk and want to engage. Oh. And I think to myself, I want to work out whether that's got that's a twin turbo V8 Merc or it's got the normally aspirated engine in it. I don't want to listen to your bloody stories about your life. I want to work, you know, that's also, he's got a different tread pattern on the right rear tyre there. Or do I say to him, you want to sort those out, mate?
Those are great games.
Turn your fog lights off.
Turn your fog lights off. Now, this is a really good one. What's your favourite shit car? I really ought to go with this is not a car that you've owned, just favorite shit car. It could be a car you've owned. So given that only one of us has owned several 6 Series convertibles, I should go to Chris Cooper first.
You say that. I know I always say this, but you've got it in your head that somehow I'm embarrassed or ashamed to have owned back-to-back 6. And the truth is I'm not. And I said to you as a weekend, I saw sometime, must have been just before New Year's Eve. We're recording this on Tuesday, 2nd of... Is it Tuesday today, 2nd of January?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
So it must have been Friday or Saturday. I happened to drive past a sort of reasonably unmolested 6 Series convertible. You can always spot unmolested 6
Series. Which gen?
Gen 1.
Yeah.
Which has got 645.
Yeah.
Which had the slightly nicer engine, if I'm honest.
It did.
Slightly nicer engine. Made a slightly better noise. And you can always tell an unmolested one because it will have the standard wheels. That is the first sign of a molested, actually lots of cars, but certainly 6 Series. So I lost the rest of the day looking for elegant and beautiful and enjoyable Sixers. Even though they
I have a photograph of you sitting on the quayside at Dover in one of those cars with a young man next to me, and I don't think it looks good.
It was Calais. You remember that? It was Calais because there'd been a fire, one of the two fires they ever had in the Eurotunnel.
Yeah.
And we had to drive back early from a race, a VLN race, because one of the diesel cars had dropped diesel just after miss.
Yeah.
And because it was diesel, it couldn't clean off. So to persuade us that it was really slippery, they got us all back into the press room, and they showed us some cameras from the circuit CCTV camera of one of those little municipal little sweeper, hoover, brusher machines. There's about 12 miles an hour on the lock stops round that tight left-hander after miss it. It's that slippery. So we all went home early.
What's the name of the tight left-hander at the bottom? Verzeifen.
1-0. Okay, you got that one.
So
paper shit car. So yeah. My brothers had one of these. And if you looked at its individual features individually, you'd think it's a bit of a shit car. 84 horsepower, I think. Plastic tailgate. A dashboard made of stuff that used to be plastic before it went downhill.
Citroen AX GT is not a shit car.
Exactly. That's why it's my favourite shit car.
No, it's a great car.
It's a great car. But if you looked at it in isolation and decomposed it, you'd think, probably weren't very good. But what a car.
I think I did my driving lessons in one of those.
It was just 84 GT, horsepower.
No, an AX.
An AX.
84 horsepower.
Tell you what, I need time to get over that. I need a bit of therapy. Manish, what's your favourite shit car?
Well, this thing should, in theory, given its pedigree and the guy who designed it, be just a godlike chariot. But it's a collection of straight lines. It looks, to some extent from the back, as if it should definitely be a hatchback, but actually it's got a boot. It predates pop-up headlights. And at the front, they look hooded, except when you turn the lights on, the hoods fall down instead of lift up.
Oh, I know what this is.
And it's a Lamborghini Jarama.
Yeah.
No, it's a pretty car.
Yes. See, that's the thing, Neil. People are very Marmite about the Jarama. And I've never driven one, but I've been in. And it's just squat, and it's just wide, and it's just low. And I think it looks like it could be a Vauxhall or a Ford. It really, really, really strange looking car. But you turn the engine on, it's a bloody front-engined Lamborghini, isn't it? I think it's about a foot shorter than your Espada, isn't it? It's a little bit wider, I think. It's a little bit shorter. You can just about get into the back seats. I just don't think it looks like a Lamborghini. I can't believe Marcello Gandini had anything to do with it. But there is something magnificent about its shittiness, or shitty about its magnificence.
I've just looked at it. It looks like a 365 GTC has run into the back of an Alfa Montreal.
Something like that, exactly. The hooded
RA is pleased with that description, and rightly so. He's pleased with that. And that almost redeems you from that ludicrous outburst about the AX GT. Ed would love it.
Well, I've written two down here, and I hope I don't offend anyone, but they're our favourite shitters cars. So
stop there. Did Edward Lovett just say he hopes he doesn't offend anyone?
Yes, I did, yeah, because some people will... This might be their favourite car, but they won't use shittest in the description of it. But I think the one that deserves probably to win the favourite shittest car has got to be an old-shaped Defender. You know, we've been very rude about them, but you find it's hard not to love one. I'm not sure I'd want to do a 12-hour journey in one particular.
We love them because they're not shit.
Well, that's your view, yeah. But that would be my favourite shitter's car. But I've also put one here. I haven't owned one of these. My godfather owned one new. And it's the sort of car that I think a lot of people would look at who have been fortunate enough to drive nice cars and think, why would anyone want to own one of those? And that is a Fiat Panda 100 HP.
Very good.
Yeah, I think, but I can imagine a lot of people drive past those and think, "Ugh, what is that?" But actually, I think that's a cool little stealthy car to own.
Yeah,
couldn't get it with clear glass. which is always frustrating to me.
Neil Clifford, what's your favourite shit car? You've got a few to choose from.
I've sold
I'm asking the man. I'm asking the man that until recently had a Bristol Fighter, for fuck's sake.
And I didn't choose not to own it.
No.
Someone else chose that for me, which is another story on Jack and Ori.
Moving on.
Well, I think this is such a complex subject because favourite shit car is different to cool shit cars because there are many, many cool shit cars. In fact, because I think this sort of driving feel thing is all a bit bollocks, a lot of cars that are cool are shit to drive, in my view. You know, a Citroen SM, which I've owned too. Actually, it's the most gorgeous car. I'd own another if I could buy back the one I stupidly sold that a man won't now sell me back. But it's quite rubbish, in truth. And it's got a brake pedal as a button.
Yeah.
So it's very unnerving. It's basically like driving the Portsmouth to Ryde hovercraft. But it's such a cool thing. It's like a Lancia Integrale, frankly, which people will hit me down with fire and flames for saying that. But I think it's different. Your favourite shit car is... I've got two, and I'll be brief. One that I own now, which is a classic Range Rover, not a Land Rover Defender, which we can argue for hours, and we've done that before. The classic Range Rover, I've got a 94 soft dash at the minute. Actually, it's super cool, but it's really shit. There's no leg room, front and back. It's quite impressive to have no leg room.
Yeah, front. The back in particular is bad.
The back is terrible. It smells of, I don't know, cigars and farts. Even if you bought it new, it would smell of cigars and farts. It's 50% chance of breaking down. It feels like the chassis is completely separate to everything else.
Technically, it is.
It feels fragile. But the car that I've still got an itch for, which I think must be really shit, but I still want one, is a Citroen C6.
Oh, yeah. Great
now,
job.
A Ooh. Citroen C6, and I'm not really totally jammed up on the models, but I'd want the, I don't know, there'd be a French name for the top of the range one, the V6 manual, yeah. Long wheelbase.
There'll be one there made for politicians that's a bit longer than the
exactly,
big
exactly, yeah.
Le Capitaine or something. Or President, like the butter.
That's why all French ministers would turn up late to meetings in a taxi because their C6 would break down around the corner.
And I still look for them on Auto Trader because they're a little too cool to be on collecting cars, funnily enough, or a little too shit, I'm not sure. And you want the navy blue one, non-metallic, that was basically used by the French embassy, you know, just opposite Harvey Nichols, parked under that little arch. And it's got like, I don't know, FAN1 or France 1 number.
FRA1.
FRS it. And it's got tan leather, navy blue. It's the long wheelbase one, the V6. Maybe, probably auto is better than manual.
Yeah.
I think a Citroen.
I'm not sure there was a manual.
Maybe not. But I think that is a really great shit car.
That's a really good answer there. I think you might have me. But I think, for me, the concept, you describe beautifully the difference between favourite shit car and a cool shit car. We can all identify cars that are objectively shit or not very good at what they do, but they have a charm about them that means that they're cool or they're beautifully styled. That's quite obvious, but this is a more complex subject.
Yes.
I want to answer it two ways. First, from sort of with my own goggles on, but also as a what it's like as a journalist. So I've got several shit cars from my youth that I thought were great, that parents had them. And I was taught that the Jensen Interceptor was amazing because one of my friend's dad had one. He'd go on about how great it was. Until I was, you know, there was no internet. It was only when I sort of started working and I was like, oh, Jensen Interceptor, they're cool. And everyone just went, well, they're terrible. I had no idea that the car was a bit of a standing joke amongst people. It really is, and it has been. It's a charming thing, but it fits into this category. It's not a very good car, but its reputation is for being cool and British and everything else. I suppose in that category, I can see joy in a Triumph TR6. I'm not trying to wind up Mr. C here, but the TR6 is, you know, never came anything other than last in a group test. because yes. it's a. I know. Sorry.
I know.
But they are. You know, it's not a great effort. I suppose the shit car. I can't find any redeeming qualities about it. It's the Triumph Stag. Whenever I see a Triumph Stag, I just feel sorry for the poor sod driving it.
Yeah.
And I suppose in the modern era, the car in my career that fitted that category was the Clio V6, which, you know, on paper was this amazing amalgam of Tom Walkinshaw's race organisation, Renault's bravery. And then when I went to the launch, there was a table of Renault people and a table of Tom Walkinshaw people. And the Tom Walkinshaw lot were going, Renault lot totally ruined this car. They're a bunch of wankers. And the Renault lot were going, we should never give it to TWR. They don't know how to wipe their own arses. And the car turned out to be an utter disaster. The second generation one was better. But I'll tell you, that's my pen. There's a category of cars that when I was a journalist fitted this so perfectly and exposed the inner boy racer in all of us. And that was hot hatchbacks, particularly hot hatchbacks, and maybe the lower end of the fast saloon categories. You'd go and do your group test and you'd film them all and you'd all sit down there and talk about steering feel and damping and all the stuff that Neil thinks is bollocks, but I think there might be a bit more to it than that. And you'd reach your conclusion, particularly hot hatchbacks. And then, if someone said, which one did you buy? You'd buy the one that was fastest against the clock because you just wanted the fastest one. You'd look at the numbers. The idea of, I can remember with a Punto GT, the turbo one, which objectively was not the best hot hatch out there. But when you drove them back to back, that thing could dust everything else because it had so much torque and a turbocharged engine. And I just always wanted the fastest one. You could keep your steering wheel and everything else.
Exactly.
I would always buy the fastest car, even if it was the shittest.
Yeah.
Because back then I just wanted the one that was quick against the clock.
MG so, Metro Turbo.
Exactly. Roger Bell yeah. wrote the most coruscating review of the Fiesta Turbo, I think it was.
With the three-spoke wheels.
Yeah. But I remember driving one and thinking, this is so much faster. I don't care about understeers. So yes, I get that. Now, the next topic, again, this is proposed by Neil Clifford, was just Vauxhall question mark. So Manish, how do you feel about that bridge near MI6?
you know, one of the joys of doing this podcast is that you do have to, especially if you're me, read around things a little bit. And I love open question, Vauxhall question mark. I didn't know that it started off as a steam engine company in Vauxhall. And then it made steam engines for boats. And then it moved to Luton and it became Vauxhall Ironworks. And then we started to get into to cars. I mean, I could go on, but I'll tell you what I was very, very blown away by was the idea that this car had a car. It was the Prince Henry, a 4-litre 75 horsepower car that was regarded as the Bentley of its time. This is an aristocratic make.
And the history, of automotive history of this company is incredible.
It's just unbelievable. Yeah. And even further, I mean, I assumed, obviously, GM bought it in the 60s. That was my assumption. They bought Opel in the 60s, and they didn't.
Way earlier.
They bought it after the First World War. So this is a company that's basically had American money put into it, along with Opel, in the interwar years. And I have to say, I discovered the Vauxhall 10-4. And I don't know, do you remember seeing the film Brazil?
Yes.
Terry Gilliam film Brazil. Yeah. I think in terms of sort of, you know, in that era, it was regarded as certainly one of the most beautifully designed movies ever. I mean, the production design in that is stunning, from the typewriter at the beginning that, you know, that the fly lands on that causes all the problems to Robert De Niro appearing to, you know, if you just look at it, it's got this very strange Art Nouveau mix with dystopian. I looked at the Vauxhall 10-4 and it's an object of absolute beauty. It is the Terry Gilliam interwar car that you'd have. And I just looked at the side of the bonnet. There are these two chrome lines.
It's beautiful. Yeah, it is.
You just go with four straights in them on either side. I even looked at, I think it was the Victor that had integrated exhaust pipes into the rear fender. So these things are just objects of such stunning design. And then to read about how effectively I mean, it's happening to us in life, I guess. Everybody's saying that that there are fewer and fewer companies that control more and more. And I guess Vauxhall, the kind of end chapters of their lives, it's the idea that it's part of a conglomerate, that it's gone from sort of 9 or 10 or 12 base cars to what will be 2, plus whatever vans they used to make. They've created cars that really rebadged Isuzus, all kinds of things. It's quite a sad story for design, for individualism, for everything that I think we hold as incredibly important in terms of cars and brands. I think it's a salutary story. It's anyway, so I'm going to get a Vauxhall 10-4. I'm going to find a beautiful one and restore it.
There's always one at Bicester.
Beautiful car.
Yeah.
Neil Clifford, what do you think of Vauxhall? And I suppose I'll expand your own question for you, which is, do you care and should it exist?
Well, I always feel sad about it because it's a brand that I should have got. It probably was peak through my lifetime, or certainly my reference points. You know, it was a brand that I've never really been able to engage with. I've always struggled with it, whether it's, I don't know, I was always Heinz, I was always Ford, and I don't know, what would Vauxhall be? Campbell's soup or something, or Campbell's baked beans. I never really got it, even when it was down to, should you get the what was the GTE thing?
Astra.
You know, I never wanted the... I mean, the coolest thing for me was, okay, you put Lotus Carlton to one side because that's always the reference point, but really it's a bloody Lotus, was the Calibra. I sort of almost got the Calibra. Frankly, it's a better looking car than most Ferraris now. You know, it's actually quite a pretty bloody car, not too over-designed. You got the square exhaust with the... Was that the turbo or the 16 valve?
The 16 valve red top got the squared off type pipes.
Yeah, got the squared off exhaust. But it was somehow, whether it be just a weakness of marketing or something, I never really got it. And I always wanted to get it because it was British. It was made, you know, in bloody Luton. It employed a lot of people in the country. You wanted to get it. It was probably number 2 manufacturer probably through the 70s and 80s too.
It wasn't it?
It was a very successful company. I've never owned one. I've never wanted one. And I feel sad about that because really we should. And it's something that it's never really clicked with me.
Would you compare a Carlton or a Senator to a Granada, for example?
Yeah. But I always wanted the Granada.
I don't know whether it was
You know, I come from a sort of upper working class background, which certainly Ford was a bit aspirational, where Vauxhall sort of wasn't quite aspirational.
The strange thing about that, the answer to that question is that in most areas, you can make a stronger argument for the Ford, but actually a Senator 24 valve was so far beyond anything Ford made with the Granada badge. At the very end of the Granada, they put a Cosworth designed 24 valve in, but it still wasn't as good. The Senator was a real problem. If you were young and trying to get away from a Fed,
if you were
being followed by one of those, there wasn't any point because
they had the square exhaust.
They could do a buck 50 all day long. They were quite fast.
Extraordinary car, exactly.
But you never wanted one.
I agree.
I thought they did a 24 valve estate. That was a cool thing.
Yes.
Did they do something like a Sigma VXR, which was like a shooting brake shape?
Yeah, the Sigma was a thing that it was sort of a hearse-shaped thing.
It was kind of it was quite cool. I don't think you'd find yourself over the last 10 years as a petrol head in a Vauxhall showroom, sort of
not the last
asking
10 years.
What's coming out next.
So Chris Cooper, what are your thoughts on the Vauxhall?
I'm very similar to Neil, really. I mean, I've sort of have a Vauxhall was a client of ours when I first set up my business. That would have been a client of ours early 2000s. And I live even closer to the factory or the head office, what was Griffin House. We went to Griffin House, which was not the original headquarters of Vauxhall and Luton, but kind of the big one. And at some point, there would have been 5,000-6,000 people working there. They did styling. They did, you know, original design engineering. They weren't just picking badges out of a box and sticking them on whatever came from Rüsselsheim or the Opel factory in Belgium. I mean, they were, it felt like a real business. When I was there, even in the early 2000s, it still felt like it was a real business trying to find its place in the world. You can sort of see a peak. I had an uncle, or sort of a in-law of an uncle, in the mid-80s, who ran the local Vauxhall Opel dealership.
Yeah.
And I remember going in and thinking, I'd have all of these. There was Mark 1 Astra GTE.
Square one.
Yeah, mate of mine at college had one. I used to run the Portsmouth Poly Motor Club. And a guy who'd had a mini Clubman with a big 1440 engine had left, gone to get his first job in industry, and with his first paycheck, bought a brand new Astra GTE. And he drove us all to the Birmingham Mo Show in 1986 or 87, something like that. I thought I'd dining on to heaven. It was just Recaro seats or the Recaro seats.
There's the Recaro.
And it just, I just thought this was just amazing. Monza GSI, Manta GTE,
definitely.
They just all look Manta. My brother had a Manta GTE,
brilliant looking car.
Just such a lovely handling thing, and just lovely balance. Engine's a bit coarse, but it just. But like Neil says, they sort of never quite. You know, you see, saw those Chevette HSs and HSRs, and you see the Russell Brooks's one, Heat for Hire.
Yeah.
That color scheme you had on those HSs and HSRs, mid-80s. They just look, just want them. I suspect.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All of the big three American companies don't have a great track record in owning and allowing to flourish European car makers.
Mm-hmm.
They've kind of all cocked it up. And you're right. I mean, Vauxhall, Ford UK has always felt, when we were growing up, we didn't really see Ford as an American business. We saw it as a British business.
Yeah.
Because the factories were all over the UK. And there was, you had the brochure, the Ford UK brochure you got at the motor show, and it had Eagle House, Worley Way, Essex. And you thought, that's a real place in the UK. It's a British company. And we thought Vauxhall was as well. But the Americans don't have a great track record, GM in particular, Saab, WTF. So it's never too much of a surprise that in the end, they didn't quite get it. And then the Calibra, we all knew the Calibra was a Cavalier. Was a bit shit.
Cavalier was hugely successful though, wasn't it?
Commercially, it was really successful. And the original Cavalier, when there was an Opel Ascona at the same time, that which the Manta was based on, was a nice rear drive chassis, quite about live axle, but quite well balanced.
By the late 80s, Vauxhall was actually killing Ford in the sales charts. You know, there was a period when it was number one.
So I feel nostalgic about it, not just because they were a client years ago and, you know, the factory and the head office is sort of just over the hill that way. It's what could have been.
Yeah.
But is it a weakness of marketing or is it a weakness of, was the car?
That's a good question. I think they certainly weren't short of money to spend on this stuff. But I think, and the Saab experience, GM latterly certainly didn't have a clue about what it was about Saab that was going to make it valuable or could make it valuable. Hence, there was a Cavalier under the Saab 900 eventually, and nobody was persuaded by that. So, and Ford's.
Do you remember Sniff Petrol's article by Bob Lutz saying, "What is a Saab?"
Yeah. Yeah.
Should have put a gun on the front.
It's a conversation all the time. We ought to some of the time come back to how bad, why did Ford get it wrong with the Premier Automotive Group? Because that's some very clever people in there.
Yeah.
Very clever people from BMW and elsewhere. And VW. So yeah, so I feel nostalgic about it. And I Griffin House is about to be knocked down. They've moved the head office to a smaller building. As you go up the M1 north from Luton, on the right-hand side, where all those new massive warehouses have been built, Junction 11A, if you look just to the right, you'll see a little Griffin flag. It's sort of a pretty nondescript 90s building. That is now the new headquarters of Vauxhall. And when you see pictures of Griffin House and Wentley, you think that kind of sums up the whole story for me.
It's... I've never really paid that much attention to Vauxhall because when I started doing this for a living, it was already slightly on the wane. They were trying, and occasionally they'd come up with something quite interesting. But by then, you could tell GM had thought, we're not going to throw money at this. I'm not qualified to have an answer of why did Vauxhall fail. If I did, I'd be earning a load of money and be considered clever. But I do think that a lot of it was about timing. There were times in its history when GM clearly invested a lot and the brand succeeded. But towards the sort of end of the 90s, early noughties, the models that were released, they probably had more money for the marketing campaign than the way the cars were developed.
Zafira.
I think famously the first Corsa, they boasted about that. There was more money for the supermodel campaigns in the magazines, you know, Christy Turlington, all that. That was more money on that than there was spent on the car. But they did fascinate me, and I am still seduced by the heritage. Like, you give me an HS 2300. There was one of those on the RAC rally that I did, and I spent more time photographing the box rear arches of that than I did any S. Give me Jimmy or Russell Brooks in one of those, and I'm all over it like a rash. And so I think the thing about... Sorry, Edward.
No, carry on.
But I suppose the thing about Vauxhall that I don't think there's a place for it now, really. I think this new Astra, even if it's a rebodied something else, is quite a clever piece of styling, actually. I sometimes think it could be a Honda. It's quite a good-looking car, and it's got nice light signatures at night.
Yeah,
lights are quite attractive, and I hope they sell a few. But I suppose where I stand on Vauxhall is, I'm not an advocate. I don't wear the T-shirt, but I will not stand by and watch people take the piss out of the brand unless they know about its history. That sounds so headmasterly, but they need to know a bit about, you know, stuff well before Lotus Cortinas, that this was a great brand and it deserves to be recognised as such. So when people glibly go, well, they're just shit, I go, no. You need to go and do some reading, boy, before you say that. And I think that's the bit that you have to respect it. You can't just wipe it from history. What it does now isn't as interesting. The Lotus Carlton has its place among the most interesting cars ever made. I think the red top engine is something that we should all celebrate. Now, Vauxhall was selling us a red top with, you know, that was heavily tunable. It was effectively a racing engine for the road, whilst Ford was trying to sell you a Cologne V6 that was made of butter. So actually, you know, GM
very good.
Was giving you some real value. And also, if we talk about the most exciting motorsport from the late 80s to the mid-90s, it's probably British touring cars. I don't have a picture of a Mondeo. I have a picture of John Clelland's name on the side of a Cavalier. I just that's what I associate with touring cars. So, yeah, I think my message is I don't really care about it so much now, but you have to respect what it stood for and what they achieved. Edward.
About 12 years ago, I was invited to go to Hereford for a on Friday night, I think, for a bit of red wine and probably some stew. And then about 6:30 on Saturday morning, we woke up, jumped into something I'd never got into before, which was a 3098. And we bumbled along, four of us, in this thing in about 3 degrees for about 25 minutes. Actually a lovely road car, given its era, 1924, 1925, something like that. And this was a lovely looking car, burgundy body. And then we pulled into a field. And for the next 2 days, we just drove it up the side of various different hills in the Herefordshire countryside doing trialing. And it was my first experience in a Vauxhall 3098. And to put that into context today, it's like going to an off-road event where you have things like Suzuki Jiminis and Fiat Panda 4x4s, and then someone turns up in a Cullinan to also play the same game. You know, that was, it was the same level. It was a lightweight engine, four-cylinder, so a smaller engine than the Bentleys of the era, but it was a lot more sporting, very quick, and I think one of the most popular sporting cars of its day.
They also made, in the modern era, Vauxhall was also responsible for selling one of the most ridiculous cars I've driven in my lifetime. And I don't use the D word regularly, but I think this wasn't far off being dangerous. The VX 220 Turbo was on a wet road. Watch out. They were so fast, and the number of those that got stacked. So they had a sense of humour as well, or they had a legal department that was on the piss. I don't know.
It's a very well reviewed car by the magazines, wasn't it?
It was so fast for the money. Cool. Okay, so this is one that slightly betrays what Neil Clifford gets up to on weekday evenings. What's your favourite leather interior? He didn't specify car, So Neil, what's your favourite leather interior?
Well, it's if anyone's ever, and this is a very niche thing to say, owned a Rolls-Royce Camargue, that has the loveliest leather interior you will ever get into in a car. You can own your 80s Bentleys, your 90s Bentleys, your Cullions, your new Rolls-Royces, your Ghosts and your bloody... all of that stuff. You get in a Camargue, and I've got an analogy, but I won't say it. But imagine the softest piece of a body.
Male or female?
Male.
Male. Shaven, male. Not shaven.
even this item from an animal. Let's take a blue whale. And you've taken this little piece up a blue whale and stitched them all together. It's the loveliest, butteriest, softest, gorgeous leather. I think if you look it up, it says semi-aniline. You know, when they made the Camargue, they wanted to make it so much more impressive than the normal Shadow or the normal whatever the two-door bloody thing's called, Corniche. And it was double the price almost of a standard Rolls-Royce. So they went really way out there. So that for sure is the loveliest leather I've ever touched, which is on a
Camargue. I'm Googling it at the moment.
Do you like the aesthetic of the Camargue, Neil?
Yes, I do.
You do?
I do, yeah. I love interior. It's like from an aeroplane, the interior.
Yeah.
I had one and it bloody broke down three times in about 6 weeks. So I just, you know, I can't remember. I think it was Edward that said as soon as a car break down, I give them three goes. I'm more tolerant than.
I think it was me that said that, and I give them two. I'm not. You're more tolerant than me.
Three in 6 weeks. It's you know, one at the wife and the dog, and you know the drama that's created by a breakdown. You have three, and it's out really.
Edward Lovett's favorite leather interior.
A car had never been driven, so it was just the fault of the previous owners, not mine, or even the guy I bought it off. Anyway, Rolls Royce Camargue.
There you go. Edward Lovett.
Back in my days working at BMW Bristol, where
right
I think
my babbers,
right my babbers. one of the fun jobs of working in the sales team is specking the showroom cars to have on display.
Great job!
You must have been an absolute disaster with your taste. Fantastic.
And I used to love specking E46 M3s in individual paints with Nappa leather. And, you know, the new Nappa leather on a 2004, 2005 E46 M3. They had all sorts of wonderful colours, but it smelt good. It was soft and silky, and it was everywhere. So that's my memory of leather of those days. I need cactus, I think, was the colour I liked.
Cactus.
Was
that a greeny one?
It was, green. Light green leather, yeah.
Wow. Chris Cooper, leather.
That reminds me of that era when I was racing caterhams in Europe in the Euro Cup. And there's a guy who at the time had been big in historic racing when historic wasn't as big, nowhere near as big as it is now. Simon Crompton, who used to be the MD of L&C, the BMW dealer down in Kent.
Yeah.
Originally an Alpina dealer before Sittner's had it. So they had, their main one was Tunbridge Wells, but they had Croydon, Banstead, a few other places. And it would have been summer 04, so peak E46 M3. And every race we went to, he had a different E46 M3 convertible.
Nice. It's
most extraordinary combinations of leather and over everything. Because he just went berserk like you. It was just...
Did he have the famous Laguna with Laguna? That was always my favourite.
Yeah, Laguna, yeah. Laguna
Seca. That was challenging. Yeah, it was
a good colour, that Laguna Seca, though.
Yeah.
But I haven't owned a Rolls-Royce Command. I know it'll come as a shock to everybody. But I was at the London Motor Show as a very young, small boy, feeling very nervous on the Rolls-Royce stand when the Command was launched.
Crikey.
And I thought, how old was I then? 8 or something? Wasn't I 76?
76, yeah.
76.
Yeah.
And it was, I just thought, it was first a spaceship. It must have been older than that, actually. A spaceship. It looked fine at the time. Then it went off. And now I think it's wonderful. You look at see one now and you think, oh, that's just amazing. So because I haven't owned one of those and I wasn't allowed inside with my little sticky little stubby fingers in the 976 Motor Show stand at Earl's Court. L322 Range Rover with nice everything leather. In it.
Mm.
You could get it with the leather roof lining. The
autobiography. Very nice, yeah.
Add a leather roof lining. I think probably the 405 as well, but I think the architecture and the general layout of the 322 is nicer than the 405.
Lots of big rotary rubberized dials to turn.
And just sort of those sort of vertical plinths or bits of wood went through the center dash. I mean, they make the 460. Jerry.
Yeah.
322.
Not a fingerprint. It's not a fingerprint inside.
Yeah. So I think that. And you can get those now. If you wanted, I mean, they're very few unmolested. I've been looking at them all over Christmas, thinking I want a clear glass, unmolested, something under 90,000 miles, if possible.
It's hard to find.
It's quite hard to find. But
someone's got my green clear glass with tobacco interior V8 supercharged facelift one. Why did I sell that?
Oh.
Bonkers. Did that have the spline spoke wheels?
It had those and it had a set of winters as well. Don't ask why did I? And it had done 30,000 miles.
Somebody's enjoying that now.
I know. Manish, what's your favourite leather interior?
I don't know whether it's Series 2 or Series 3. I can't remember. But a friend's dad had a Daimler 66 Van Den Plaar.
Nice.
I don't know if it was a Van Den Plaar. It was definitely a 66. And the leather interior in that was mind-blowing. And the clever thing about that car, remember, it's not like your Berlinetta Boxer's beautiful signature Daytona seats. There's something sort of so specific about it. There's something so sort of 70s sofa about way that the Daimler's leather works. It doesn't seem specific to it. It's just so insanely comfortable. And the way the walnut sets off the leather, and it's just everything about it was just so meticulous.
The Series Stop One is the one, really.
They're lovely.
It really,
yeah. Beautiful. The Series beautiful. One is the
Give
one.
Me Series One. Series.
Yeah. Did we just sell one of those on Collecting Cars? But it's still.
Yeah, you did. Yeah.
Jag XJ12.
Yeah, done a few miles. The leather interior thing is interesting. I don't really like leather seats most of the time. I prefer sort of corduroy finish or a cloth seat. But there was something very, as a young kid, my parents never had leather seats. So when you get in a car with leather seats, there was this smell of it's expensive. It would really hit you. You'd think, blimey, this is a bit exotic. I'm not a vegetarian, but I like to think I've got some ethics around that sort of thing. So the idea of thinking that a dead animal smells good is a bit odd, but they do. You know, it's just the car does smell great. And it's an amazing product that we've tried to replace, but there isn't really a replacement for it in the way that we use it. So personally, I'm not that into leather interiors, but the two that really sort of stand out for me are, one, Renault very kindly in 2004 let me have a Renault Clio V6 second generation car as a long-termer. And normally these things, you just get told you can have one, but Renault very kindly said, you can spec it if you want. Ooh. I said, well, surely you can't really spec these things. And they said, no, you can. There's a few options. And they said, the one thing we're doing, but we don't want to shout about it, is we're doing a special leather interior package that means that actually the door cards are in leather. It's, you know, it's a Clio dash, but you can do the whole rear deck where the engine bay is inside the car in leather as well, and around the sides.
Wow.
And they said it's a nightmare to do. No one's picked it up as an option in the UK, really, but we wouldn't mind having one out there that has this. So do you mind? Go on, go for it. I went, okay. So the car was made in Dieppe, then shipped to Monaco, where some outfit did this leather, beautiful leather interior, and it was a really high quality leather, and they shipped it back, and that car is somewhere in it, and some owner will have it, or is known to be a bit special because it's got this gold paintwork it's got black paintwork with gold flake in it, and
yes,
leather interior. And I always remember the leather would get a bit warm when the engine got warm, and the whole car smelled, it's the most leathery smelling car I've ever been in, and it did smell expensive. So I quite like that, but I'm a bit biased because I've just spent Christmas over, you know, last 2 weeks in a Bentley Flying Spur. For me, Neil can dismiss, you can keep your Bentleys, but for me, it's all about Bentley interiors. I'm sorry, they have the best hides. Once you've been to the factory and seen the respect and the care and the love they put into these interiors, I just love them. I think a Mulsanne interior is unlike anything else. The others, yeah, they try. Some of them are a bit more funky and technical, but there's something about sitting in a big Benter's seat and just looking around you. And the only time I get probably more excited by an interior, and that is an addict's word, is when I sit, and this comes back to what Edward was saying, when I sit in a car that should normally have not leather, but there's someone's optioned insane levels of leather. Like in a Porsche, when you see someone that's gone for the air vent slats, and you know that that's about $4,000.
Yeah.
And then you start looking around going, oh my God, that's leather as well. What isn't leather? I don't want that car, but I do look at it and think that's ridiculous. But yeah, I find it quite amusing, I suppose. Here we go then. This is something that I don't buy into whatsoever. So I'll sit here with my cynical hat on and give you a glib answer afterwards. What are our 2024 cars and hopes? I'm going to start with Edward Lovett, who's going to say that he wants collecting cars to sell 20 million cars so we can retire to a private island somewhere off Phuket.
Well, as you've just finished that with talking about leather, the first thing I've put is Bentley ownership. I think there needs to be a Bentley appearing in one's life over the course of 2024. I don't know if it'll be an old shitter or it'll be something someone lends me. But some Bentley ownership in my life.
Definitely.
Given the weather and the speed the clouds are moving out here, I'm quite looking forward to a bit of spring weather already.
Yeah.
Already. And then Chris and I are off to New Zealand on the 23rd of January. And we are going to be doing an event there and an event in Australia on the 4th. So I'm very looking forward to engaging in our Southern Hemisphere community. That's 2024, or the first part of it anyway.
Manish Pandey.
The thing that most matters to me this year is getting our beautiful Ferrari project off the ground. Seeing Chris Cooper driving...
I'm coming.
You're coming. So I think we're all going. But I think seeing Chris Harris and Luca Montezemolo...
Oh, yes.
...lap Italy in a Ferrari, talking about how that brand was built and why everybody fell in love with it, at least for a period of time, and getting some really good inside stories on the Schumacher era and what it took to make that happen. And does Kimmy actually eat food, or does he just drink all the time in and out of it? I mean, we want to see that made. That's my absolute obsession for this year.
I'm up for it.
It'd be amazing. And very
Chris Cooper.
So just a codicil on 2023. So I think most people have seen by now that our sport was delighted to see that Ron Dennis is now Sir Ron Dennis. Congratulations, Ron and family and everybody.
Absolute
involved.
Card-carrying legend.
He's extraordinary.
All negative stories, go and look at what he's done.
Yeah, he part of his honour was for his more recent, clearly big charitable activities, the Podium Analytics, this charity that he chairs, which is about helping young people who have been injured in sport or preventing injury in sport. Wonderful.
Can I add one thing there as well? If anyone here knows Ron or is connected to Ron, please can you tell him that we love Ron and I want to do a podcast with him. So
okay,
I will pass that on.
I'll send him a text now.
Yeah, I'll pass that on.
He's just here. I'll just talk to him.
And also, Christian Horner for CBE.
I mean, seriously.
Can you say, dear Ronald, we want to get you on our podcast. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, we might need 3 days.
Sorry, Chris.
So Christian Horner got a CBE, and also Duke of Richmond, Charles March, also got a CBE. So we're delighted for all of those. So my 24 goals are about... I think everyone should go and enjoy the local car show, not these car meets. That's a completely different thing. So on Boxing Day, near where I actually sort of between where Neil and I live, at Sarratt Green, there was just a Boxing Day car meet. People brought along. I took along our old Defender. One of the blokes on the farm took Lynn's TR6. One of the blokes on the farm took their old Massey Ferguson. He's got a 35S. Which is like the Turbo S version of what I've got. I was really upset. So go and look, go and enjoy a local car show. It would be a great ambition for everybody. Two other things I'd love to, it won't be on this year, but the Rally with No Name, Monkey, which you fabulously and spectacularly won by 0.6 of a second. If you haven't watched the film, go, it's a wonderful film. Monkey is quite impressive. Two things I think we should do together. I think we should ask our viewers and listeners to provide us with a design for a soapbox, and then we should enter it in a race. The other thing I think we should do is lawnmower racing. There's a 12-hour lawnmower race.
Are you secretly launching a chiropractic business that you want to somehow boost sales to?
If not now, then never.
A 12-hour lawnmower race.
Well, there's shorter ones, but there's a 12-hour one in August. It goes overnight in August. It would have to be a group. I think it's group 3 or class 3 lawnmower. So it's a sit-on, but it's not like the big tractor one. It's sit-on, but it's like look a go-kart with a. They take the blades off.
Sorry,
I think
we should
do. If somebody would like to submit a design for a soapbox to us, we'll buy the bits, and then we'll draw lots for who's going to do gravity racing. So those are my ambitions of the year.
I know some fine MRI scanners in London. We're all good.
Does one have a lawnmower that we could enter?
I've got an old wheel horse that's shit itself.
Yeah, we've got one round. I had a conversation on it the weekend. When you see the Red Bull soapbox thing, people use bicycle tires, which don't work on a four-wheel vehicle, because bicycle tires work because they distribute the load, you know, through the axis of the cycle tire. If you put four cycle tires on a vehicle, they go, doesn't work. But a narrow, so if somebody's going to submit a design to us of a soapbox, disc wheels that are non-spoked, disc wheels, probably quite a big diameter, narrow gauge, lower rolling resistance, bit of centrifugal stability. But I'll leave the engineers and our audience to tell us what fast looks like.
It sounds like an opportunity for collectinglawnmowers.com.
Yeah.
Neil Clifford, what are your goals for 2024?
Well, look, I love lists, and I adore January because it's an ability to reinvent yourself and get that horrible old skin off and New Year and all that. I don't like December. I don't like Christmas. So January for me is a very busy, hectic time around writing lists of things that I want to do, personal, work, health, cars, any old shit. I've got lists for everything in my phone. It's magic. I'm going to read a couple of them out. I've got about 20 in my car goals 2024 list. I'm not going to read all of them because it'd be very boring. But to drive around, actually, most of them are transferred from fucking 2023 as well, which is really the annoying thing about lists. Because unfortunately, when you know you have all these lovely cars, means you actually bloody work a lot, which means you can't actually do the shit you want to do with the cars. It's one of life's big dilemmas, which I'd love to share in more detail about that challenge. Anyway, drive around the whole circumference of Italy.
Yeah.
With my wife. Yeah. That's been there since about 2012, that one on the list. But I will do that. I will do that at some point. Hopefully.
In a what, Neil? In a what?
In a car that's made also in Italy, northern Italy, I would suggest. Because then, of course, you're treated lovely and you won't get speeding tickets and everyone's charming to you. I want to do the Tour Auto. I've got three things. I've actually managed to do one of them, which was the Targa Florio. So I want to do Mille Miglia, and I want to do Tour Auto, and I did the Targa Florio, thank God, just about with my lovely friends. And so Tour Auto and Mille Miglia is going to be on this list, hopefully, until I take them off the list, as opposed to dying when they're still on the list. I want to go to Japan. And I want to buy a car in Japan. I adore Japan. Anyone that doesn't like Japan, I probably don't like you. I think Japan, America, and Italy are the only three places really that you can go on holiday, and they're just magic. I want to fly to Tokyo, buy an MX-5, and just drive around all the cool little beaches, mountains, mega little crazy towns. So Japan is a thing. I want to improve my driving skills. What else have I got here? I want to go to the Dolomites.
Oh,
around, yeah, with my Italian charming, lovely friends with their beautifully trimmed hair and navy blue outfits in the Dolomites. So that's about four of the 20 things I want to do. But write lists. Writing lists.
Yeah, lists are good.
Lists are good.
Lists are good.
So
I didn't reinforce that one, eh?
So I'm not really into the two phrases that I really am allergic to are dry January and I'm not interested. If you don't want to drink, keep it yourself. And also New Year's resolutions. That's just bollocks. Don't get it anyhow. But I quite like the idea. So car goals I quite like. So I'm with Edward. I'm going to own a Bentley this year. But the way I'll fund it will keep everyone, let's say, highly amused.
You're going to finally become that armed robber we knew you were.
Yeah.
Potentially. I want to drive my rally cars more this year because my performance on the RAC wasn't great, and I had a very difficult week, and it wasn't good. And I think I've got unfinished business with rally. I want to go to the Nürburgring again because I haven't been for years. I'd like to just go on a track day, just go with some friends. So
if anyone of the addicts
wanted to come along, we'll show you how you go around there. We'll go and drink some beer and eat some sausages.
Lovely.
On a non-car related thing, I've got a really shit old speedboat that everyone laughs at because it's got a silly name. And it's made of plastic. But when I'm out on the water with my kids skiing and wakeboarding, it's one of the happiest times of my life. I didn't use it last year, so I want to get that out in the water.
Nice.
I want to do the Monte Centauri again with Chris Wilson, who's a big part of collecting cars. And I had a great time doing that. Well, unfinished business. I want to work with Neil Carey more because he's my man husband who I work with a lot. He's wonderful. I want to go to the Isle of Man TT again, which I'm definitely about to book my tickets because it's one of the best things I've ever done. And I want to do as much as I can with the addicts as possible this year, both professionally and non-professionally. So that I want to do as much as possible, and I want to make some great content that makes me feel proud. But then that's not about January. That I should be thinking that every day of the week and every week of the year, shouldn't I? So I think on that note, let's move on to some music. And able to go, well, I didn't know we were doing music.
Two-car garage.
Two-car garage.
Oh shit, two car garage. Yeah. Right, okay. So this time, actually, there's no big narrative that I have to read out, which is quite good for me. But there
is
a
music.
Oh Jesus. Because we want to present ourselves as being, you know, speaking to the ordinary man and woman, we're going to go for something that's a bit more parsimonious. So you've got 20 grand to spend on two cars. That's it. And as Chris Cooper quite brilliantly said, we can worry about the running costs in February. That's all you need to know, okay? So that opens it up a bit to the dance floor. So, Edward Lovett, off you go.
Okay, so I've decided to buy, because I've never owned one, a TVR, because I think we need a bit of open-top V8. And obviously, we've got 20 grand here, and I'm going to need some change for number two. So it's going to have to be a Chimera. Is that right?
Chimera.
Yeah.
Chimeras. Yeah. And they did a four-litre or a 4.0.
Yeah, we had one. We had a 4-litre, 240 horsepower one, yeah.
Clearly, I don't need to worry about whether it works or the running costs, but I've bought one of those. And yeah. I have been onto a competitor's website to get some inspiration for this. And the other car that I found is an original first generation KNS manual.
That's
a car.
And I'm going to pimp it up and turn it into a Trans-Siberia spec, which is kind of a... I think they got all the Porsche dealers in the UK in 2023 to find a KN and turn them into Trans-Siberia Expresses. And then they went up to the place that Tuttle goes up to in Wales. What's the bowl called?
Walter's Arena.
Walter's Arena. I think they were having some fun up there. So that's my two-car garage, a manual V8 SKN and a 4.2-litre Chimera.
That's nice.
Neil Clifford.
Right, how much we got?
20 grand.
20 grand.
Two cars.
Okay. I'm going man of the people, Ford Mondeo ST220 V6, right? And you'll be able to go and nick one of these. A guy's been polishing it from bloody day one. He's got the mirrors underneath the front of the engine when he takes it to the shows. It's got 30,000 miles from new, original plates, all the service history. In fact, he was a mechanic at the Ford dealership, so he nicked all the stuff when he got made redundant. He's been servicing it for the last 20 years in his garage. Absolutely fantastic thing. And no one would ever look at it, but it's a cool car, that. It's like 7 grand, right? And then you want something sporty. You know it's going to break down, but you don't really care. What are you going to buy? It's got to be an Alfa Romeo. You're going to buy an Alfa Giulia, maybe the Cup if you can. You know, the V6 one, 93, 94. Hopefully that lovely turquoise blue with the tan. Those lovely leather seats, actually. Beautiful. Frankly, it's an Alfa SZ, but just better made, because an SZ's shit and, you know, all the bloody panels are wonky. And that's 10 grand. So you've got 3 grand left for servicing and, or basically taking your partner and drive around Italy in the Alfa.
Manage, 20 grand, two cars.
There's a flash card. Can you see them?
Yep.
Oh.
XR3i and an X19.
Oh, exactly. That's what I'm getting. When I was a kid, there was a big XR3i, and I always liked the hard top more than the convertible.
Yeah,
maybe controversial, but those two, they said it was the car of the brain surgeon. That's what they said. A brain surgeon would buy that car. But I completely bought into that. My friend Dan bought an X19, and he took me to university in it. My first day at university with my several suitcases, posters, and all the rest of it was in a black X19. And we had to take that bit off because it doesn't have much luggage space. I think they're great cars. The XR3i, £8,600, and the X19, £11,300. I have £100 left over for those university pints.
That's a toppy X19.
That is. Toppy X19, that is. That's toppy.
Best one in the country. Chris Cooper.
I got three. Well, I had two.
Oh, God.
I had two, but I got a bonus one. I'll come to it right at the end. It's a really good one. I also had a TBR, so I've parked that because I had a backup, obviously. So my first main two were in 2002 E46 330 cab, 63,000 miles, 7K. Nice car, proper car. All these are proper cars for 20 grand. Then the 2009. So I found blue over, it was blue over black. I was trying to find blue over cream, but blue over black. No, still nice. 2009 C63 wagon, 72,000 miles, 13 grand. So that's your 20. But because the third one is such a steal, Jack, one of the guys on the farm, Jack is the guy who was in the winning team of the Fast and the Farmerish. And yesterday I noticed in the farm there was a 2004 R53 Mini Cooper S. It's got 75,000 miles. It's grey with the chili pack.
Yeah.
Got to have the chili pack.
Bluetooth?
Yeah. Didn't check that. I think it has. Yeah, it's got a mobile on it. It must have Bluetooth. It's got a mobile on it. Black roof, that sort of light grey metallic, clear, chili pack wheels. £1,000 he paid for it. That's such a lot of car for the money.
They were great. They are
£1,000. I said to him, I'll give you 1500 for it. He said, no, it's worth a lot more than that. So 21,000, but R53, Mini Cooper S.
Yeah.
75,000 miles, 20 years old, chili pack, clear glass, black roof, grey, £1,000. That's a January bargain.
And without realizing it, but somewhat inevitably, Chris Cooper has just invented the three-car garage on Collecting Addicts.
£41,000.
There's it's a really, really good group of cars, that. But of course, you're both, well, all of you are wrong. So it's a very leggy, water-damaged Cat N B7 RS4 Avant. And it's and just because Chris Cooper's wrong, it's an AX GT. And if you have both of those, you would be the happiest little. You'd be the happiest little French Iranian in the Southwest, because they are just. Honestly, when I see those two cars written down on paper, they make me more excited than just about all the new shite that I drive. Yeah. I think they're great. So, somewhat prematurely, I said let's do some music about 10 minutes ago, but now let's do some music. We'll start off with Edward Lovett, who will say, "I didn't know we're doing music this week."
What Love Is, Zimmer 90. It'll go, you can listen to it afterwards.
Zimmer, right, okay. Yeah. Manish Pandey.
I went to see the Ferrari movie. I think we've all seen the Ferrari movie. I wrote a script which was basically not that dissimilar in terms of its period. I wrote 57, 58. And this Ferrari movie has the death of Castellotti. And the way it was realized by Michael Mann was that people were at church, people were doing their jobs, and they could hear Castellotti going for a lap time, and there was some CGI and all the rest of it, all the stuff that I hate. And the way that I'd written it was a slow motion scene, and I'd had him dying at dawn, so I took a little bit of poetic license, and I had this beautiful red, the Ferrari, the prototipo that he went with, one chrome body panel that it just hadn't been finished. So you imagine this thing at dawn, and it had been wet the night before. So the sun's just coming up and you see this car as a silhouette, and I slowed time down. And what happened is he was going out with, what was her name? Not Fiamma Bresci. He was going out with the singer. Anyway, he was going out with the singer, and I imagined her singing this piece of music. It's from the opera Rinaldo by Handel, and it's Lascia ch'io pianga, let me cry. So she's singing, Castellotti's driving, Castellotti has his accident, and she's holding a rose in her hand, and the rose explodes, lots and lots of red petals. And that's the death of Castellotti. And that's what this piece of music will always be.
And that's by Handel.
By Handel. Last year, listen to it by Cecilia Bartoli. That's the best version. So beautiful.
Writing that down. Neil Clifford.
I've been mainly listening to jazz over the Christmas period. Yes.
It's interesting. In Bristol, you really watch jazz. You don't tend to listen to it.
Well, I would recommend if you're ever going to get pneumonia, get it on Christmas Eve, because you can have a nice long period of relaxation between having to get better and go back to work and listen to jazz in the middle. And I would recommend, I was going to recommend an album, but obviously can't put an album on there. So John Coltrane, Love Supreme, and Part Four, which is Psalm, which is very, very good. I'd recommend that. So put that on there, please.
Can you repeat it? So I can write down Rob Coltrane.
It's John Coltrane.
John Coltrane.
The album's a Love Supreme, and it's the Part Four. There's four parts to the album. On vinyl, of course, I'm listening it too. So you have to get up and let's turn it over for Part Three and Four, which is all very sophisticated and lovely.
It is these days, yeah.
Yeah.
Chris Cooper.
So I was a bit worried about, we all were a bit worried about Neil. So I had a little picture book sent over to Neil on Christmas Eve, one of the books I showed last time, actually. So we're all glad you're peak of fitness again.
I am.
I can't really follow Manish, and particularly because it's shitting down outside, it's January, and you just need a bit of a rah to get going. So I picked Thunderstruck AC/DC.
Oh, good.
I've had much as I said, I find it difficult when people are in the car and they distract my inner car observations and the fact that I don't want interruptions. I spent a lot of time in car with my children, and I do love that. And actually, when you're in the car with your children, sometimes you want to just play music that you feel they should know about, so you feel it's an educational process. Sometimes we just listen to Cabin Pressure on a loop because it's the funniest, best thing I've ever heard on radio. But sometimes you want a song that just makes you laugh. And for me, there's no more joyous song than Johnny Cash's Boy Named Sue.
Oh, brilliant.
We always listen to it together, and we just cry with laughter at how clever it is and how... Just it's gorgeous. So Boy Named Sue is a great thing to listen to with your kids.
Mm.
And that brings...
Before we go, could we just have a moment silence to a man that I wish I'd got to know him better, but I knew him a little bit. And I had the best conversation with him in Abu Dhabi about what it is to build a team and what it is to really develop young drivers. And that was Gilles de Ferran.
Yeah.
Just... amazing human being. And if you ever met Gilles, he was a Jaguar to most people's leopards. He was just a little bit bigger, just a little bit more powerful, but he had the best smile. And I think one thing everybody would say about Gilles is that his sincerity really, really didn't care what you did. You could be Bernie, or you could be, you know, Chase Carey, or you could be a mechanic. He'd speak to you in exactly the same way. And very, very rarely have I met someone who I just, his charm, his intellect, and his strength just impressed me so much. So little tiny thought to Gilles de Ferran.
I've never met him, but obviously the sort of eulogies that have come out on social media and in the publications are, you know, they have to be sincere. People can't be that insincere.
Yeah.
But I only saw him compete once. And actually, I wanted to write about it, but then I thought to myself, am I trying to make myself look like I know the bloke? And I stopped, and I didn't. So I'm embarrassed. But I went to Rockingham when they had the IndyCar race. I went for there was a test and qualifying day. And we were, I think the media were all invited to go. So we all went along to this new facility. And the cars only run fast for one lap, because there was a drainage issue and they couldn't drive. And they sent the driver down. And I remember seeing him. He was the only car that we saw go into turn one, absolutely with the afterburners lit at Rockingham. And I'd never seen a car on a kind of off square overly thing in my life. And I think all of us had a bit of a kind of, it's just shit F1 and ovals mean nothing. But in one corner, he silenced most of the British motorsport and motoring media, because I've never heard more, and it was men then, I've never heard more men in a room go, fuck me.
Yeah.
So everyone just said exactly the same thing. We all went, fuck me, as it went through turn one. And then the flags came out and we never saw another. We didn't see anything else that day, just one corner, and it was his car.
Didn't realize you were there. I was at that race. That was the first of the two Champ Car races held at Rockingham. And there was a weeper just before turn one.
Yeah.
because it was newly built. And I was there because a lot of my mates worked for Reynard at the time, quite coincidentally. So we had some seats just on the exit of turn one. And he won that race right at the end from Kenny Brack.
Yep.
And he was just so super brave. And it's the first and only super speedway tri-oval, whatever you call it, I'd ever seen. I couldn't believe how brave and extraordinary they were. It was just... So to have been there to see Gilles win that 2001 Champ Car, winning Champ Car at the time, a rocky and wonderful. So yeah, no, well said, Manish, here, here.
Okay, that ends today's lesson. And we'll see you next week for episode 48. Bye-bye.
See you later.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.